so with that, as you can see from the new cartoon that we have on the blog and on the homepage, I'm in Pleasanton in San Francisco Bay Area, and Franklin is at Top of the World Farm. So Franklin, are you with us?
I'm right here.
Well, you're about the busiest man on the planet. I've been teasing Franklin all week about how busy he is. Anyway, Franklin, there is so much going on in the precious metals market. I don't know where to start, but I know you do. Bring us up to date on the market since we talked last month. How are we doing and what's going on?
Well, what we did was really pretty remarkable because gold and silver both broke out of and broke through the downtrend lines from the downtrends that had been established since gold and silver both fell off in September. And so what that means is that it's clearly turned around. Now, when I say clearly, of course, I'm going to put all sorts of footnotes and qualifications on that. But there are two numbers that I really look at closely. One is the 300-day moving average in silver, and the other one is the 150-day moving average in gold. And the reason I look at those is because generally those have served as a safety net for gold and silver over the course of this bull market. And by that, what I mean is they just very seldom go below those numbers. And when they do go below those numbers and come back up through them, then that is a significant buying opportunity because you've had a correction, you've had a bottom, and now it's ready to go up again. And here's where the rally has stalled, because although gold went through its 150-day moving average and has kept on going, silver did not move through its 300-day moving average. So there's a kind of a non-confirmation there, and what I think is that you're going to get a correction that may take silver down to $31, maybe could go lower, and gold might go as low as $16.80, $16.50. But there's not much question that they've already bottomed. I think we saw the lows in December, on the 29th of December, and now from here they're going to resume their upward climb. So in other words, you've gotten your notification, hey, low price has been reached, fixing to start climbing again. And when I say fixing to start climbing again, I mean they may go sideways for the first half of this year, but after that they're going to go much, much higher. And when I say much, much higher, Catherine, I don't throw around numbers a lot, but I think the top of this particular leg that we're in is probably $4,500, and for silver, probably $150 or more. So this is going to be a huge move up. This is going to be bigger than anything we've seen yet. So the difference between 1730 and 1850 is not going to look very big 2 years from now.
Right. Right. I remember. I remember 2004 torturing because I was working with a client and we just delayed a little bit and we had to pay $400 instead of $399. And I remember being very depressed about it. Now I look back and I say, why?
What difference does that make? Yeah, exactly.
What difference does that make? Right. And, so many times in the last 5 years, Franklin, generally in about 90% of the time when I don't wait and I just go ahead and buy, 90% of the time I'm better off. And yet I find myself every week in a situation where a subscriber or a client is new to the market and the question is, should they take their core position now or should they wait? And, you know, it may just be a dollar, it just may be $5, but, you know, every penny counts. So
right.
I find myself tortured about these things every day. despite the, you know, you would think after listening to you all these years, I'd have a little more perspective.
Well, I know, but I do the same thing to myself, you know, and what we're doing is the, as the cliche goes, we're letting the good be the enemy of the better, or the, however they say it. But I mean, you know, you can't get perfection in markets. If we were trying to do that, then we'd be trading this stuff every day, in and out, and trying to make a profit that way. Well, we're not doing that. We're not even trying to do that. That would be a very, you know, that's not a good way to play it. And if you're playing the long term, the primary trend, you have to play the primary trend. You can't keep, you know, throwing your eyes around the world and saying, oh gosh, the grass is greener over there, because you'll just get yourself in trouble.
So let's look at the new, somebody who's new to the precious metals market. What should they do today? Should they wait? Should they buy? Should they buy some to get a core position and buy some later? What would you advise somebody coming in?
That latter sounds like a good thing, but one thing about it is, if you get gold closing above 1805 and silver above 3450, stop waiting. Do not wait.
Right.
Buy. But just blindly buy, because above those levels, it has broken out to a new rally. And what you're going to see here, you know, markets often go back for the final kiss goodbye when they break out. They break out, they go up a little ways, and then they come back to the downtrend line or the place where they broke out, and they make what we call a final kiss goodbye. And then they turn around and they're gone after that. They just skyrocket after that. So, I don't think waiting is a good idea. I also, first of all, I think you've already seen the lowest prices. They may be slightly lower, and you may get buy silver some lower, but you're just going to be shooting yourself in the foot in the end. Because when it gets down, if silver dropped down to 28, I'll guarantee you that same vacillation would be on you, saying, well, maybe it'll go to 27.5, and you just have to go on and buy it, because, as I said, you're buying it for the long term. You know, turning to the currencies, if we can.
Yeah, please.
Something really weird was going on there in the last week and a half, where almost every day the yen cost about 100 yen cost about 131 cents, and a euro cost about 131 cents. And those markets don't go that flat for that long. So I suspect that our friends in the government were manipulating that market to try and keep the yen,
Somebody wanted parity.
Right. Well, I mean, that's what it looks like, to try to keep that euro from dropping too much against either the yen or the dollar. And the dollar, it's not clear that the dollar is ready to sink, because the dollar has gotten down to 78.50, the dollar index, and it refuses to go down below 78.50. So, you know, it's not clear what's going to happen in the currencies, but I think for the euro, it's as good as it gets. What you saw today, well, maybe, you know, when the Greek parliament finally approves the debt deal, that might be a tiny bit better. But basically, it's as good as it gets. There isn't any more good news. And that market did not sink today on the news that the deal had been practically consummated. Well, normally what would happen is, on news like that, all those people who were expecting the euro to go down and who were expecting the deal to fall through, the euro to drop, they would be short euros. But and they would close out their positions when that didn't happen. Well, that nothing changed. The euro just barely moved. It was like 0.2%, which is not a big move. And nothing happened with stocks either. And supposedly the cloud hanging over stocks has been what would happen with the European crisis. So those markets are not reacting the way they ought to.
Well, when you look at earnings projections, though, because the projected earnings are way down.
Yeah.
Or you look at the Baltic Dry Index. What I see everywhere I turn around is you see slowing. You know, it's almost as everything is stalled. And of course, stalling is not good news for commodities, particularly industrial commodities. So I know before the call I got you to go take a look at the, you know, the Baltic Dry Shipping Index. It's a swan dive down. But if Europe is in a real serious recession, that means slowness for the United States, and that means slowness for the emerging markets too.
Right. Right. They're not independent of each other. That's
right.
For sure. Yeah. So I don't, you know, right now I think we've got probably a little correction on the table with gold and silver, and that went, and I would only alter that. That would only be contradicted if you saw silver go below 2615 and gold go below 1530. And I certainly don't expect that. I think the worst is behind us now. I do think that we're going to get a chance to swap gold for silver at 57.5 or a little better. I think you're going to get weakness in the stock market, and when that happens, the silver moves very strongly in its direction against gold. Silver moves kind of in the same direction that stocks move. So if you get a lot of weakness in gold, then you can if you get a lot of weakness in stocks against gold, then you're going to get weakness in silver against gold too. And I think you'll see that sometime soon, and then that ratio will start coming down again. And this time, it'll right now it's about 51.3, and this time it'll go down to 30, 28.
Right, that's
like that.
That's I forget who was it. I guess it was you saying 4,500 for gold and 150 for silver, which is a 30 ratio.
Right. Well, Al Field had an article about that, but those are numbers that I'd come to independently, so that makes them even that they have that much more weight to me. If somebody as bright as he is looks and sees that too, then maybe there is something there. Makes it look like a better forecast.
So you think that could happen in the next couple months?
Oh, gold going to 4,500? No.
The ratio going to 57. In other words,
it will happen. Or it'll either happen in the next 2 months or it'll never happen.
Okay.
There's not a lot of time for that.
Okay. So if somebody wants to swap, they should they should work out in their minds how they're going to do it now. And be
all
ready
the arrangements need to be made now, because that is you don't have time to change that.
Right.
You don't have time to do it when it actually happens, and it's a week later and you hear about it. There's no time to do it. Yeah, they ought to put in open orders to do it, or else they ought to watch it pretty closely.
Okay. So I want to talk. I have a couple questions, and then I want to talk a little bit about the longer run. A couple questions. One question was, why do you use Elliott Wave Analysis? Often when you talk, you sounds like you're using more standard charting techniques. What's the argument for Elliott Wave?
I don't have an argument for Elliott Wave. There are people who claim that it works. It's clearly, I'm too dumb to figure out how it works. The only reason that I use it is in retrospect. In other words, after a market has made a big move, it's easier to pick it out to me then. I can't predict with it, because every Elliott Wave practitioner I've ever listened to, and believe me, they're smarter than I am. I don't claim to be. I don't claim anything else. But everyone that I've ever used just pulls rules out of the air so fast that I can't keep up with them. It was once described to me as by a friend of mine who's a third generation commodity trader as the technical system that's cost more people more money than any other technical system known to man. And that may be true. I don't know. But I don't use it except in retrospect. In other words, to sort of prove where I've been.
Okay. And then what do you use? You're tracking. Well, you just said you used.
Well, I look at moving averages, and then I look at lateral support, and then I look at downtrend lines and uptrend lines, and I look for patterns on charts. You know, it's when you start looking at charts, it's pretty plain that you get areas where the market is trying to go up and it can't get through those areas, and it'll try twice and then suddenly it'll burst through. Well, that's an area of resistance, and then on the if you turn that upside down, it's an area of support. And those patterns are pretty plain on the chart. I mean, those areas are pretty plain on the chart. And then there are patterns like equilateral triangles or rising wedges or falling wedges. All those things, it's a very bad idea to go to make a decision against those technical indicators, because people have used them for years and years for a reason, namely because they have a pretty high predictive value. So,
okay, so a second question. There's been a sprinkling of articles around the internet talking about the possibility of special taxes on gold and silver, particularly if we get the kind of move up that you're talking about, or even confiscation. And we have a question from one subscriber saying, is there any merit to switching to platinum or palladium to avoid those kind of special taxes?
I don't think there is. I don't expect those. I don't expect those special taxes in the first place. I mean, you know, you have to really stretch your mind to picture the government doing that particular thing. Just like you, I can't stretch my mind far enough to see the government confiscating gold or silver. And of course, they might put special taxes on, you know, they'll call them windfall profits taxes or something like that. But I really don't think they would do that, and typically they don't do that unless it's part of some other great big huge so-called reform. So I don't see any advantage to that. Another thing I don't like about platinum and palladium is that the market is not nearly as liquid as the market for silver and gold, and so the spread that you have to pay is larger than it is for silver and gold. But I'm not enthusiastic about platinum and palladium because they're both very quirky. They have quirky demand profiles. They have quirky supply profiles. And I don't see how platinum and palladium are going to do very well. Now, they may rise, but I don't see how they're going to do very well in an economy that's headed down, because they're both, the demand for both is determined by industrial demand.
Right.
And how many automobiles, that automobile catalysts are very large factors in the consumption of both platinum and palladium. How many automobiles are going to be built during a depression or a recession? So I'm not saying that platinum and palladium are bad, but I would not have a huge investment in them in relation to gold or silver. They're just too quirky.
If you were to look for a wild card that could bring the price of gold and silver down a lot, would a rise in interest rates be the most likely thing? What could bring gold and silver
down?
No,
the election of Ron Paul would be the most likely thing. because if Ron Paul got into office, then the days of the Fed would be numbered, and the economy would begin to recover, and people would go back to investing in productive assets instead of having to buy gold and silver to protect their assets from monetary depreciation. I think it's going to be very simple. The interest rate, it's true, has an effect on the price of gold. But at some point in an inflation, the inflation is such a danger that even high interest rates cannot tempt investors out of it. Do you know how high Volcker had to twist interest rates to squeeze the gold 21%. And silver market to death in 1980?
21%. 21%.
24%.
I don't remember that, but it could have been. Yeah, it could have been. All I know is the long bond, the New York 30-year bond for New York State was 18%.
Well, just think about that. That's a long ways from 0% that your friend Mr. Bernanke has said he's going to keep interest rates at until 2014, which is two more years.
Well, remember, he's keeping them at 0% for the big guys. But if you are on Main Street and you're trying to get a loan, forget it. So So,
well, you're
you
just
know,
not going to get the loan.
Right. So, you know, it's 30 to 90% on Main Street, although it's 0% at your local hedge fund who's buying, you know, who Obama wants to sell the foreclosed properties to.
Right. Right.
So, yeah. Yeah, it's
but I
so this
can't,
gets
they're not going to raise what can Obama do? I mean, Bernanke do? What's he going to do? Raise interest rates to 17% overnight? Not going to
no.
do that. I mean, you know, if he lets them rise, he's going to let them rise 0.5% a quarter at the most for a year or 2 years.
If he wants to manage commodity prices down, he can just keep raising margin requirements. I mean, margin requirements will buy you a lot.
That's
so.
True.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But
interest
rates won't.
It's interesting. If you were, I heard a great presentation on the radio the other day about a guy was talking about if, you know, what happens if we lose the futures market and people can't hedge their businesses. It's a very compelling presentation, but let me ask you something, Franklin. Would you, as a small farmer, this year use the futures market to hedge your crop after what happened with MF Global? I'd be afraid to.
Oh, I don't see how you could have any trust in that. You'd have to go, what will happen is that there will be another market will form, but it'll be an over-the-counter market. In other words, there won't be an open outcry central market like the COMEX is today. But people who run grain elevators, for instance, will offer offer futures contracts in effect.
Right.
They'll make deals. But anybody, I think you've gotten to the point where you can't trust the market. Remember, it wasn't MF Global as a broker going down that was so astonishing or created a new situation. That's happened many times in the past. What creates the new situation is that the COMEX messed over their customers. That's what the new situation is. And if the COMEX stabs the customer in the back, then that's the end of the COMEX. If you can't trust them, there's nobody you can trust. Forget the broker.
Because not only did they stab him in the back, but they, you know, I was walking in to get coffee 2 weeks ago, and there on the Wall Street Journal was the headline, customer money accounts money lost in chaotic trading. Well, you and I both know in both the securities and the banking system, nothing clears without, you know, it going from one, you know, there's a debit and there's a credit.
Right.
So I don't care how chaotic the thing is, the transfer, there's a credit, there's a debit and there's a credit.
Right.
And so it went someplace. It's, you know, the whole society, we keep hearing that. So it's not just that they stole the money, but they lied, you know, a lie that without any, you know, it's almost sort of thumbing your nose at somebody or worse. Because it's we're not even going to bother to come up with a good lie.
Right. It's like today's deal with the banks. They're parading around like they're heroes now. The banks are. What? They got the government to set up a deal where all of their bad paper will be converted to good paper. The paper they can't enforce is going to be converted to good paper.
Right. And that's their payback
all these
for
state attorney generals are throwing out their chests and strutting around about how they showed those banks. Yeah, right. They showed the banks. Sure they did.
Okay, so I want to go out and talk about the end game because where all this is going. CBO published an annual report, and I put a blog commentary up. It's off the homepage now, but if you just put in CBO in the search box, you can pull it up. And it's stunning, Franklin, because remember, this is an election year. And I'm used to the Congressional Budget Office not publishing things in election year that's going to get anybody in trouble.
Right.
And yet, here we have the CBO saying that the GNP growth this year is going to be about 2%, and then next year after the election, it's going to be 1%. Now, if they're expanding the money supply at 10% or greater,
right,
and the GNP is going up at 1%, that means we're shrinking by 9%.
That means it's not working anymore.
Right, it's not working anymore.
This is the same phenomenon that an alcoholic experiences when he finds out that quart of vodka won't do the job anymore, and he's having to buy handles now, you know, half gallon.
Right.
So that's what that means. But here's the thing about that CBO report that really I find scary. Susan and I were driving up to Nashville today. I had to take her up to Nashville, and we were listening to the radio, and one of the items pointed out in the Greek debt deal was that they would reduce pensions. And I turned around and looked at Susan, and I said, reduce pensions? So here you've got people that have been working all these years. They expect to retire. And, you know, I don't know a lot of people who working people who have cushy pensions. And now all of a sudden they find out they're not going to be able to get all of their pension. Well, that's exactly what
USA News 3 days ago had a big story. It's up on the blog. 9 states moved to reduce pension benefits. When Panetta's been squabbling with the military. Big article USA Today on the cushy benefits for the military and whether or not they should be cut back. So, you know, we've been talking about this on the Salieri Report a lot, but I think one of the end games is absolutely to debase and cut all the retirement promises.
Well, exactly, and that's what shows up in this CBO report, because it shows that the crisis in Social Security comes not in 2022, as the Social Security Administration says, but in 2019, and it comes with instead of an $8 billion hole, it comes with $1.2 trillion hole, something like that. So, in other words, people now who are on Social Security already, they're going to get out there and they're going to find out Social Security can't pay anymore. And look, let's face it, Catherine, Social Security does not keep you living in the lap of luxury.
Right.
You do not buy fine wines on a Social Security income. And you have to understand, two-thirds of the people in some of our states have no other income but Social Security.
Right.
Nothing. So what are they going to do? Let those people starve? What will happen when those people do not get Social Security?
Well, but let's look at the federal budget outlays. One of the things, another thing in the CBO study is they say unemployment's going up next year. They have it going up from, I think, 8 point something to over 9, say 9.2. And, of course, that 9 number is a big number. Now, again, John Williams at ShadowStats is saying it's 22.5 now. So we're talking about approaching Great Depression levels, although not, you know, the Great Depression didn't have the level of sort of food stamps and other things. But
right.
What that means to U.S. government budget outlays, let's take a look at. In 2000, the budget outlays were $1.9 trillion. 2011, they're $3.8 trillion. So we're talking about a squeeze coming across the board. And that, if you look at those outlays, part of that is just the money supply expanding. In 2001, the monetary base was $6.6 billion. In 2012, it was $2.6 trillion. So it's gone up, what, 4 times?
Yeah.
Much more than the outlays. That's part of the squeeze and the slow burn.
But I think you have to point out, too, that these things are already baked into the cake.
Right.
These are not. We're not talking about problems that will arise if things get worse. They're already there. The numbers are already there.
Right. It's and now I mentioned this earlier. The when you look at what the CBO was saying about the budget,
mm-hmm.
when I was doing the articles on the missing money, Franklin, on the $4 trillion that went missing from federal agencies.
Uh-huh.
Individual taxes, I helped Kelly Amir do a big cover story for Insight Magazine. Individual tax receipts that year, it was 2000 or 2001, was $1.6 trillion. And corporate income was almost $600,000, about $550 billion. So we're talking about, you know, over $2 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
What the CBO is projecting for this year is that individual receipts are down over 33%. It's at $1.15 trillion, and corporate at about $250. So not even $1.5 trillion. That's a huge drop in revenues. And when you look at everything we're saying, what you're looking at is a machinery. You know how I'm always talking about how federal government investment in places has a negative return on investment?
Right.
Well, what's happened is the negative return has gone on long enough and gotten deep enough that now it's cutting into their revenues. So the machine has turned so much negative that it doesn't have enough revenues to keep feeding the machine. And as we're watching the U.S. attack the Swiss over getting, you know, getting all those accounts wrapped up and into the tax system, and trying to shut off any leakage of that money going abroad, you know, they want it coming through this channel. You know, you're talking about a machinery that is literally desperate for revenues. It's a desperate machine. Now, somebody knows this, and this is a credit to Simon Black, who sent out this email today with some great statistics in it. He had the number of FBI background checks to obtain a firearm in the United States.
Uh-huh.
In 2004, there were 8.7 million. Guess how many there were in 2011?
More, I'll bet.
16.45 million.
Whoa.
Whoa, you know, so it's a doubling. It's a doubling. So, you know, whether it's a doubling of food stamps or a doubling of firearms or a doubling of outlays, the model, you know, you've got a negative return on investment model, and it's going around and around. And I put up a great quote, and it was in our update today from, it was a recent quote from Ron Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And let me pull it up for you because it was so funny. He's such a funny guy. Wait a minute. It was on the update. Oh, he said, the government is run by special interests clawing away at a shrinking pie, and things are becoming quite vicious. Because, you know, it's funny because the guys over in Davos at the World Economic Forum were talking about we need to change the model. And, you know, I said when I was up at the Rogue Valley, we were talking about the same thing, but from a different perspective. And the reality is, if everything's in this negative return on investment, you know, fighting and getting more vicious isn't going to solve anything. You have to change the model. And,
right.
And so I think the question for every one of us is, okay, what do I do? What's next? What's my next step? And, you know, because there's no point in waiting for the guys in Washington to change the model. They're just going to, you know, it looks to me like there is no end game. So we're going to have to create the end game. And with that, before we get off this topic, I wanted to talk about the annuity proposal from Treasury, which, of course, in the face of the numbers we've just described, makes me very nervous about my clients' IRAs and 401ks, because you see Treasury coming out and promoting annuities and the importance of baby boomers having a lifelong income instead of just an asset. They can take an asset and convert it to a lifelong income so they have income as long as they live. Well, if inflation is running at 6% and the dollar's debasing, the idea of converting that into an asset, you know, that is debasing, or a lifelong income that is debasing, is not very attractive to me. Now, you know me, I keep saying I've never met an annuity I liked, but I think, you know, I look at that, Franklin, and I say, is this a way to help build the operational infrastructure they need to figure out how to get all the service providers in that world? Because we're talking, you know, if we talk both 401ks and IRAs, we're talking about $7 or $8 trillion and enormous fee flows to the financial institutions. And
right.
As a matter of disclosure, I should include myself. And so, you know, that's a lot of detail to get worked out. So you never start with the big bang of mandating, you know, that everybody's money become an annuity. We have, I should just mention, in the commentary we have on the blog, we have links to a lot of her old posts about the different proposals for mandatory annuities, so you can look at the history of this thing to your heart's content. But I just think this annuity proposal makes me even more nervous. You got any thoughts about that?
Well, I never met an annuity I liked either. And I've just talked to a lot of older people who are my customers who've just been taken to the cleaners by annuities. And if you have inflation rates like what we've had in the last few years, it takes a very short time for the loss in your annuity payment, for the loss in purchasing power in your annuity payment to show up. And, you know, an annuity only works where you have a stable or deflating currency. Otherwise, it's
right.
just nothing but a certificate of confiscation.
Right. Has anybody ever come up with an annuity priced in gold?
No, but, you know, I've showed a lot of people how to make a self-administered gold annuity. And basically,
right.
you know, an annuity is a pile of – you give somebody a pile of money, and they give you back the money in dribs and drabs over a long period
right.
of time. And they're hoping that they can make enough interest using your money to pay you back. Well, why do you need somebody else to do that for you? Why can't you just go out, take your pile of money, go buy a pile of gold, and then as you need money, you sell off an ounce of gold or half an ounce or 2 ounces or whatever you need. And, you know, it's pretty easy to figure out. If you're 70 years old, you figure, well, I've got another 20 years to live, and I want to have X number of dollars a month to live on, let's just say $1,750, which is an ounce right now, then all I have to do is multiply 20 by 12, and I get 240 months, so I need 240 ounces. And, you know, I just hope I die when the gold road runs out, that's all.
Right.
But it's very simple to do. And you just administer it yourself. It's not hard.
Right, I know. I give huge weight to maintaining control.
Yes.
So I don't – why not just keep control so that if something starts happening or the world changes, you're flexible, you can fire them and take your money and go someplace else. And
well, exactly. And if you've got a self-administered gold annuity, what you can do is when that day comes, and we know it will come, that it's time to get out of silver and gold, you can take your annuity, sell the gold or silver, and then go buy yourself whatever investment makes the most sense then. So yeah, I agree with you. You keep control. You keep both custody or title. You have custody and control. You have title and control to your own annuity. Why do I need an annuity company to do that for me?
Well, because what you have to do is you have to live with the uncertainty and volatility and the organic reality of the world. But what I found is there is enormous benefits to learning to live with that. You know,
in the last 10 years, it's all been on your side, right?
Yes.
In the last 10 years, all of that volatility has worked in your benefit. If you were holding either gold or silver, the volatility has worked in your benefit because even though it goes up and down, the long-term trend of the dollar is down and the long-term trend of the gold and silver is up, and they rise faster than the dollar loses purchasing power. Right.
Well, if you look across the markets, as long as you're in a primary trend,
uh-huh.
the volatility works in your favor. It's not just gold and silver. It's any primary trend, it works in your favor.
Right.
So,
well, I mean, I'm looking at my year-end summaries now, and I see that the average gain for silver since 2001, average yearly gain, which takes all the volatility and irons it out, is 20.3%. And the average gain for silver is 17.1%. Well, clearly, if you started out back then with an annuity, it's been working in your favor this whole time.
Right.